Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. We're beginning the programme with another moment which seems to invite us all to rub our eyes and check that what we're seeing and hearing really is what's happening. We're about to play you excerpts from the acceptance speech of the man who's just been elected, within his own party, to become the next Prime Minister of Canada. He's Mark Carney, and he's expected to take over from Justin Trudeau in the coming days. Mark Carney is a former central bank governor, both in Canada and in Britain, so a sober, technocratic type. But listen to some of what he has had to say about Canada's closest ally, the United States, with whom they are embroiled in a battle over tariffs, taxes on imports, in other words, a battle begun by President Trump, part of a campaign, he says, to turn Canada into America's 51st state. This is some of what Mark Carney had to say on Sunday evening in Canada.
So Donald Trump thinks he can weaken us with his plan to divide and conquer. Pierre Poilievre's plan will leave us divided and ready to be conquered. Because a person who worships at the altar of Donald Trump will kneel before him, not stand up to him. The Americans want our resources, our water, our land, our country. Think about it. If they succeeded, they would destroy our way of life. And Canada never, ever will be part of America in any way, shape, or form. The Canadian government has rightly retaliated and is rightly retaliating with our own tariffs that will have maximum impact in the United States and minimum impact here in Canada. My government will keep our tariffs on until the Americans show us respect. We didn't ask for this fight, but Canadians are always ready when someone else drops the gloves. So the Americans, they should make no mistake, in trade as in hockey, Canada will win.
And that was Mark Carney speaking. For those not au fait with their ice hockey, dropping the glove is the precursor in the game to a fist fight. Cody Bloys is a member of Canada's Parliament for the governing Liberal Party. Did he vote for Mark Carney? And what does he make of him?
I sure did vote for Mark Carney. I endorsed him early in the campaign, and a lot of Liberal members across the country voted for him as well. He had a tremendous mandate last night, 86% of the vote across the country. And to put that in context for your listeners, Tim, Justin Trudeau, when he won his mandate in 2013 for the Liberal Party, in really what was a coronation, won about mid-70s. And so it shows how high Carney had in terms of the support across the country. And what I make of it is that Liberal members and Canadians who joined the party to be able to support Mark are deeply committed to trying to see him become not only our Prime Minister for the short term, but to win a general election and have him govern for the next 4 years.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the key thing, isn't it? I mean, you described it as a strong mandate. It is within its limited electorate. But, you know, this is a man who is not, I mean, he holds no elected office at all. I mean, elected within the party, but he obviously hasn't been elected by the country, and he is not even a member of Parliament.
What I would say, Tim, is I had calls across the country and certainly in my own riding. You're right. Obviously, he has a mandate from the Liberal Party. Parliament is set to go back on March 24th. There's questions about whether or not that will happen or we will find ourselves into a general election before that time. But I think Mr. Carney understands that, yes, he will have to get a mandate from the Canadian people. But it's important to recognize that there are people that join the Liberal Party. I had conversations with people that said, I voted Conservative my entire life. I will be voting Liberal this time if Mark Carney is your leader, which of course happened last night. There is a groundswell of support for his leadership and our party. I had a conversation with you about a month ago. I had a conversation with one of your colleagues just after Christmas when Mr. Trudeau had stepped down. We were 20 points down in the polls. We are now neck and neck with the Conservatives. And that is a testament to Mark Carney's leadership and the interest in him as the leader and our prime minister. And it's obviously a reflection of some of the challenges that we're seeing from Donald Trump as well.
Well, you mentioned challenges, which is a polite way of putting it. I mean, Mark Carney himself, even if he were now to beat the polls, which I think still have the Liberal Party a little bit down on the Conservatives, and become the next Prime Minister, I mean, that is really going to be the test, isn't it? What he can do. I mean, he came out with some surprisingly strong talk for a former central banker when he spoke last night. You know, what can he really do, do you think, to try and face down Donald Trump?
I think what I would say about Mark's speech last night is it is a reflection of the political mood in this country. Canadians are upset. We are frustrated. We have been concerned with what we're seeing from Mr. Trump and his administration, particularly in the economic and even sovereignty type of threats towards Canada. So I thought Mark did a very good job reflecting the mood of the country last night. And he highlighted what has to be the focus. And he said it very well in his acceptance speech. We cannot control Donald Trump, but we can control what we do in our own country. Mark has great economic and fiscal credentials. He wants to position the Canadian economy to be the best in the G7, focus on being able to focus on competitive issues in our country, how we build up our supply chains, how we look for other trading partners. Let's be honest, you know, that won't be easy overnight, but Canada has what the world needs in natural resources, agricultural products, steel. You know, we have what the world needs.
Yeah, I mean, and I sort of can hear those arguments that, look, we will need to diversify and maybe think about new markets, and we've got lots of sort of wonderful natural resources that we can dangle in front of people. But I mean, as you pointed out, that's in the much longer term to affect those sorts of changes. There will be a tremendous amount of short to medium term pain for Canada, isn't there? And it's difficult to see how, even with all his central banking skills, he might be able to soften that.
Mark Carney is the only person in the world to have ever been the governor of two central banks in the G7. Your listeners would know his work and as the governor of the Bank of England. He brings arguably the best private sector resume of any federal leader in Canadian history. Obviously, we have some really important deadlines coming up, March 12th being a deadline around steel and aluminum tariff supply globally. That would have a big impact on Canada. April 2nd, the whole world will be watching as certainly Secretary Lutnick is musing about the idea of kind of reciprocal or global tariffs. So this is not just Canada alone. This is a global question. But I'm proud of the work that our government has done. And with Mark Carney at the helm of our government, I'm confident that we will be able to continue to have those dialogues.
Can I just ask one further thing, which is one of the signature policies of Justin Trudeau was bringing in what was going to be a carbon tax. Mark Carney has made very strong suggestions that he's going to kill that. And obviously, he will try and allow a bit of breathing space for Canadian industry and your fossil fuel riches. There will be people who say it's a short-term gain at the expense of the climate.
No, Mark highlighted very well. And look, I'm a member of Parliament that would have pushed Mr. Trudeau's government to make amendments to our national carbon price strategy. What Mark has highlighted is that there's two different prices on carbon. One is an industrial price amongst the largest emitters in the country, which will remain. The other is a downward consumer-facing price, which he said has become divisive. I would agree with him on that. And he has rightfully highlighted it only represents about 10% of the emission reduction that our government had put in place as part of our Paris Climate Accord goals. So Mark has rightfully highlighted that we can continue to make environmental progress, but this particular policy on the consumer level in a country as big as Canada, geographically wide and dispersed, it had become a sticking point politically. And I think Mark is doing absolutely the right thing.
And that was Cody Bryce, member of Canada's Parliament with the governing Liberal Party. From a US trade war with Canada, the ninth biggest economy in the world, to swinging punches at the second biggest economy in the world, China. Today, Beijing imposed retaliatory tariffs on a range of US imports, mainly agricultural, along with some extra obstacles in the way of US companies doing business in China. These measures come in after President Trump had raised tariffs on the more than $400 billion worth of Chinese goods which come into the US each year. Stephen McDonald is our correspondent in Beijing.
Well, as of today, in response to the Trump administration's 20% tariffs on all Chinese goods, China has whacked 10% tariffs on the likes of soybeans, sorghum, pork, beef, fruit, vegetables, and 15% tariffs on chicken, wheat, corn and cotton. Now, you'll notice they're all farm products. And why might the Chinese government be doing this? Well, that's a real sort of punch in the head to Trump's base. These are the farmers who presumably, or at least many of them, voted for Donald Trump. And the US president has said to them, oh, don't worry, we're going to pull these tariffs up and now you can sell more within the United States. Well, I'm sure the farming community in the US would also like to have the option of selling their produce into the massive Chinese market. And so by having these tariffs placed on them, it's going to hit these key supporters of Donald Trump. Interestingly, too, people should keep in mind, I mean, the US under Donald Trump has put 20% tariffs on all Chinese goods. Now, at the moment, Beijing is just targeting these agricultural products mostly. They've got plenty of option to ratchet this up if they want to. And so it seems that Beijing wants to cut a deal, as Donald Trump would say, to try and somehow rein this trade war in. But if that doesn't pan out, well, there are plenty more US goods they can stick tariffs on in response to what Donald Trump's already done.
We've started the program talking about Canada, which is hugely exposed because of the amount that it exports to the US. How far is it the case with China that it also, there's an imbalance here, that China is potentially a bigger loser in a trade war because it exports more?
Well, actually, Canada is also copping a whack from China as well, because over the weekend, the Chinese government has decided to also put tariffs on Canadian agricultural products. That's because Canada put tariffs on Chinese electric cars. And so wherever you look, this is all being ramped up. Going back to your original point, if China is exporting more to the US than US is exporting to China, I guess in theory you could say China has the potential to be hurt more. But what people need to also take into account, the world's complicated now in terms of all these sort of trade links. What if you're a manufacturer inside the US and one of the components that's going into your equipment comes from China? Well, you've got to import that, then pay tariff on that, which increases the cost of your US produced goods. And that ultimately means US consumers are going to pay for that. Now, Chinese government has massive problems, and the last thing they need is a trade war. You're in China, you can see it everywhere. The property crisis, all these unfinished blocks of flats. They've got local government debt. They've got a huge problem with youth unemployment. Now, they had these bits and pieces of bright areas of the economy in tech, electric cars, solar panels, DeepSeek, all this type of stuff. But they're all export-led portions of the economy. So China wants to sell stuff.
And that was our Beijing correspondent, Stephen McDonald, speaking to me. This is NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service. And coming up on the programme, the people of Greenland go to the polls tomorrow in an election overshadowed by, guess who?
We need Greenland for national security and even international security, and we're working with everybody involved to try and get it. And I think we're going to get it. One way or the other, we're going to get it.
Donald Trump and the threats that he's been making about taking over Greenland. Well, he sees it as an opportunity rather than a threat, but we'll be hearing what Greenlanders make of it all in about 20 minutes. Headlines this hour from the BBC newsroom. The US has announced the extent of cuts to its main overseas aid agency, USAID. Funding's to be slashed by 83%. And Syria's defence ministry says it's ended military operations in strongholds of the former president Bashar al-Assad, in which hundreds of civilians are reported to have been killed. You're with the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour, live from London with me, Tim Franks. In Gaza, there's a sense of a ceasefire wobbling ever more precariously. At the same time, Israel has decided to try to put the squeeze further on Hamas, with its decision over the weekend to cut off all electricity supplies to the enclave. Israeli negotiators have headed to Qatar today for talks with mediators on extending the ceasefire. But there remains a big gap between Israel's wish for a continuation of a temporary truce, accompanied by further hostage releases, and Hamas's demand that the war be ended entirely. Ghada Al-Kurd is a writer and journalist in Gaza City.
We are depending on some generators that run by fuel, which is not allowed now to be entered from the Israeli crossings, and with some solar power panels. And it's not available for all of the people here, and most of it, it's being destroyed.
So what effect do you think this will have? There is a concern that maybe the desalination plant that is used to provide drinking water, that will now not be able to operate.
Exactly. Fuel is needed here and everything. We are depending on fuel for hospitals, for water, and in the street to remove the rubbles. And this will affect all aspects of life here in Gaza. If it will not be provided to Gaza Strip, I think everything will be stopped here.
All this is happening during Ramadan, which obviously is a month where, you know, it's a demanding time for Muslims around the world. There's the blockade on all humanitarian supplies coming in. Mm-hmm. What is that doing to the price of food?
Well, just for your information, it's 1 week actually, or more than 1 week, that we are running out from food supplies. I mean, especially in Ramadan, we have to do many kinds of meals. But for now, we are coming back to canned food. We don't have a chicken. We don't have meat. Even the vegetables is running out. The storage of traders, it's running out. So whenever you are going to market, you cannot find anything. And even like charity food, which is distributed for displaced people or for people in tents also, they depending on the gas, and it's not available for now. So they are coming back again for wood fire, which is unhealthy for our kids and even for ourselves. So the same circle as the beginning of the October 7th is coming back again. And we are facing another war, not the explosion or airstrikes. It's the blockade, the siege and famine war against the Palestinian here.
And, you know, we're being told that negotiators from both sides, well, it's now the Israelis who are going to Qatar for talks with mediators. Obviously, Hamas has been involved in that. When you hear these things, and obviously this is against the backdrop of the ceasefire, which is sort of holding at the moment, do you follow all the events day to day? Do you sort of dare to hope that that will be the case? Or do you just think, I cannot deal with the uncertainty, I'm just going to try and survive day to day?
Well, we have mixed feeling regarding this. The negotiators are Hamas and Israel. I think both of them, they are don't care too much about the Palestinian life here who are suffering. For me as a Palestinian, I will consider myself as a Palestinian citizen here. I'm suffering from all of these things. I don't see anything on the ground. The suffering is still the same. All the time we are running after electricity, water, internet to do our work. And this is not a good life. So I think the negotiator, they will put more pressure on Hamas to accept the extension of the first phase of ceasefire to release more hostages. And maybe in the upcoming few days, they will reach some kind of agreement and maybe Israel will allow to open the Israeli crossings. So maybe the situation will get better a little bit, not too much, but still the suffering is the same. The situation is getting worse and worse. But the most important thing now is to release more hostages and then the reconstruction process of the Palestinian life will be delayed for many years and this will push them for another direction maybe to go out from Gaza.
Khrada Alkoud speaking to me from Gaza City. Hackers thought to be working for the North Korean regime have successfully cashed out at least $300 million of their record-breaking $1.5 billion heist from the crypto company Bybit. North Korea's infamous Lazarus Group is accused of being behind a litany of huge hacks, with the money then siphoned into the Hermit Nation's weapons program. Our cyber correspondent Joe Tidy has this report.
Sound check, technical check, are we live?
This is Ben Zhao, CEO and founder of the Bybit cryptocurrency exchange. He's about to make an announcement that every CEO dreads.
Well, about 2 hours ago, Bybit experienced a hack. As far as we know, this could be the largest hack in the history of our industry.
In fact, it's probably the biggest single theft in any industry ever. $1.5 billion dollars gone in seconds. And even in the early hours after the hack, fingers began immediately pointing in one direction. North Korea. The impoverished country has one of the most advanced cyber teams in the world and is blamed for a growing list of massive, lucrative cyber attacks. Cybersecurity experts like Dr. Dorit Dorr from Checkpoint have been tracking them for years.
They don't have a successful industry for anything, so they created a successful industry for hacking. And they don't care about the negative impression of cybercrime.
Dr. Beverly McCann from Darktrace says North Korea has made billions from hacks.
They have been around for at least 15 years doing this. They have been very involved in a variety of large attacks over the years. And what they'll do with that money is they use it to fund their military missile programs.
But the Bybit heist dwarfs all previous financial hacks. So how was it pulled off? Like all crypto exchanges, Bybit has a float of crypto coins ready to be sold and swapped in so-called hot wallets. When the hot wallets are running low, more crypto coins are taken out of huge reserve pots called cold wallets that are kept super secure and offline, therefore safe from hackers. But the cybercriminals targeted a company called Safe Wallet that Bybit uses to transfer coins from its reserve cold wallets to its hot wallets. Everything looked normal for Bybit as they set up the mega transfer of Ethereum coins to the usual place, but the hackers had secretly changed the address that the coins were being sent to. By the time they realized the coins had been sent to the criminals, it was too late. Bybit insisted that no customers would lose money. They've now replenished their reserves. But the company is, in its words, waging war on the hackers. They're offering bounties to anyone who can help track the stolen money as the hackers try and cash it out through crypto exchanges. So far, 20 volunteers have been awarded a share of $4 million in rewards, but they're up against a skilled adversary.
So here we have Bybit, the exchange, and this represents the theft of funds.
Crypto investigators Elliptic are experts at charting the movements of criminal crypto funds. Every transaction is published on a public blockchain. Dr. Tom Robinson and his team have enormous, ever-changing graphs showing the web of transactions made by the hackers.
And so we're seeing the funds split up and sent out and layered. So
what, it's just an explosion of crypto in different directions.
It is, yes. And what they're really trying to do here is confuse the money trail, make it more difficult or to slow down the tracing of these funds, because every minute really matters here. Out of all the illicit actors involved in cryptocurrency, North Korea really are the best at laundering crypto.
For years now, the US and allies have accused the country of orchestrating cybercrime. Names and photos of alleged North Korean hackers have been added to a cyber most wanted list. But unless they leave the country, the chances of them being arrested are very slim.
And that was Joe Tidy, our cyber correspondent. You're listening to NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. Just over 2 months ago, a series of wildfires engulfed parts of Los Angeles, changing America's second largest city forever. More than 16,000 homes and businesses were destroyed and 29 people died. The BBC has returned to the city to find out what went wrong and what may happen next. Emma Vardy has this report from LA.
All your memories gone.
It's all burned. It's all ash.
This was not a typical fire. As Dr. Sarah Trepanier found out, it was rapid and fast moving.
You literally can see the flames getting huge and burning down the hill. My neighbors next door grew up in the Palisades, and he kept saying to us, you need to calm down because this type of fire happens in this area. And in order for it to hit our houses, it would have to burn down the town.
But the fire did destroy most of the town. Dr. Trepanier lost her home, and so did thousands of others. Wildfires happen regularly in California, but rarely in winter, and not like this. 8 months of drought meant the ground was tinder dry. High winds fanned the flames.
I'm a climate scientist. I work at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
Scientists like Dr. Ben Hamlington say global warming made the fires worse.
I didn't think we were on the front line of climate change. Otherwise, I wouldn't have bought a house here. I feel kind of like a terrible climate scientist buying a house and putting my family in a place that was so at risk. But in reflection, when it happened, it kind of makes sense, right? This is how we expect climate change to play out. the way that it's going to express and affect people is through events like this that are going to increase in how severe they are, how often they happen, and then where they happen.
In the immediate aftermath of the disaster, the Los Angeles County Fire Department said there are not enough firefighters in LA County to address separate fires of this magnitude. Here's Freddie Escobar, president of United Firefighters of Los Angeles.
Nobody wanted this. It's unfortunate that it's taken this disaster to address the issues that we've been saying for decades, that the Los Angeles Fire Department is a woefully understaffed fire department, and we're asking our leaders to make it a priority.
The mayor's office says it has increased the fire department's budget to record amounts and delivered the first raise that firefighters have seen in years. LA County and many fire victims are suing the local power company, Southern California Edison, for allegedly starting one of the fires. Lawyer Gerald Singleton represents more than 1,600 people who lost homes and loved ones in the fire that began in Altadena.
There's actually several videos, but one in particular shows the fire starting. You see a couple of instances where there are flashes, and then you see the arcing going down to the ground and the fire starting.
The insurance industry's total bill could reach $40 billion, and many fear the disaster will make it much harder to get home insurance in the future. For those who remain, learning how to live alongside the dangers posed by climate change will be key to avoiding similar tragedy in the years ahead.
And that was Emma Vardy reporting from Los Angeles. You're with the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour, live from London with me, Tim Franks. It was 3 weeks ago that we saw those extraordinary pictures of the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio across a polished mahogany table in Saudi Arabia from the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. It was one of the most telling portraits of a changing world order and the immense challenge for Ukraine in sustaining its defence against the Russian invasion. That challenge, of course, deepened with the Oval Office bust-up between President Zelensky and Trump. Mr. Rubio and the US National Security Advisor Mike Waltz are now heading back to the Saudi capital. They're travelling today for talks with their Ukrainian counterparts. They're due to happen on Tuesday and are seen as being potentially crucial to the course of the war and maybe the entire future of Ukraine, given the pressure from Donald Trump for there to be a negotiated peace deal as soon as possible. This is what Mr. Trump had to say to reporters on Sunday.
Well, I think they will sign the minerals deal, but I want them to want peace. Right now, they haven't shown it to the extent that they should. I think right now they haven't, but I think they will be, and I think it's going to become evident over the next 2 or 3 days. I think eventually, look, we have to have peace.
President Trump making reference to that deal on extracting Ukrainian minerals, which he wants to sign with Ukraine as payback for previous American military support for the country. Military support, which he has now suspended. So what can the Ukrainians offer the Americans at the table on Tuesday? Alina Frolova is a former Deputy Defense Minister of Ukraine. She's now with the Kyiv-based think tank, the Center for Defense Strategies.
I think that we can offer a lot, yes, and we can offer some kind of like not weak position and quite a strong position, for example, at the battlefield in sea. We can offer some kind of defense investments and technologies. We can offer our experience in battlefield. However, I'm not sure that this is something which the United States is looking for. It seems that they have a little bit different vision on everything, what's going on, and a little bit different targets in all those negotiations and deals.
Well, given that, and I hear your interpretation, I suppose I go back to that question. I mean, what can the Ukrainians do, in a sense, to get the Americans back on side? Because, yes, you may provide a different point of view, which you think is perfectly valid. It doesn't feel as if particularly the man in the White House is keen to listen to that.
Frankly saying, my opinion is that nothing can influence now on the decision of Trump and his administration. And the best result for Ukraine, I would say so, is to continue to keep on and to continue prolonged time of decision making in this regard, because I'm absolutely sure that Trump will be quite disappointed in Putin's behavior and his reactions and Trump proposals, but it will take time. And I think that the best a strategy for Ukraine now is to keep the negotiations open, but to prolong the time of negotiations.
Yeah, I guess the risk with that is that Mr. Trump then might hear the spin out of Moscow, which is that, look, we're very keen to sue for peace, but it's Ukraine who are behaving as spoilers. I mean, just on Friday, he said that he was, and this was just after a fairly hefty barrage from the Russians that had killed many Ukrainians, he said, I'm finding it easier to deal with Moscow than Kiev.
For now on, yes. As I said, we do not expect that Putin will seriously consider some kind of compromises and to reach the peace deal or ceasefire as a first step. But you're absolutely sure that, yes, Ukraine will be in the position where we will have to invent many alternative options, because as I said, we do not expect that American opinion, of administration will change a lot. So I think that Ukraine need to develop, which actually is done now, the simultaneous tracks with European Union, with UK, with other alternative partners who can support us on the battlefield.
Do you think the blunt truth, though, is that essentially Ukraine will need to accept there being, I mean, I'm not talking about a complete peace deal, but there being a ceasefire before there is any talk of US security guarantees? And I know that up to this point, President Zelensky had said we need US security guarantees before we can go any further. President Trump's made it clear that he's not going to happen. So do you think that in the first instance, Ukraine will have to accept a ceasefire?
The ceasefire also can be different. I think that the President Zelensky made quite a good proposal about the ceasefire, to make a ceasefire on sea and in air, which some kind of practical issues which can be controlled, which can be observed, and which can be kept. Because we're absolutely sure that Russia won't keep the complete ceasefire on the front line. And we'll see what will happen with that proposal, because that proposal is quite a framing and can be agreed before as a first step before the guarantees. But just a complete ceasefire, which will be violated immediately, is not something which we can accept, because then the next steps are not clear yet.
Do you think there's any hope of a swift resumption to U.S. military and intelligence aid?
I think that only internal public pressure can change somehow this position, and we can expect some, I hope, release of data, of intelligence data. However, I do not expect the fast release of the American aid, and this is the situation which we have now.
And just briefly, Alina, I mean, are you seeing that effect already on the battlefield?
Intelligence, yes. The absence of assistance, not yet. We have some storage here, but intelligence, obviously, yes.
And that was Alina Frolova from the Center for Strategic Studies, speaking to me from Kiev. Greenland goes to the polls on Tuesday in what could be a pivotal election. The truth is, this is a vote which rarely garners outside attention, but following Donald Trump's interest in acquiring the Arctic territory, the world is watching more closely than ever before. Now, the question of independence, of Greenland's continued status as an autonomous territory in the Kingdom of Denmark, well, all that is dominating the debate, as Adrian Murray reports.
In a sports hall in Copenhagen, FC Nanuk are meeting up for their weekly training session. The players share a passion for football and their Greenlandic roots. Though their homeland may be far away, its future is weighing on their minds as their countrymen go to the polls tomorrow. Alec Bertelsen says the spotlight on Greenland has been unreal.
It's been crazy. I think it's been surrealistic, and when we're such a small community, yeah, unbelievable, actually.
Greenland is a semi-autonomous territory within the Kingdom of Denmark,
and the question of independence has taken centre stage. The country is 9 times larger than the UK, but with a population of just 57,000. Another 17,000 Greenlanders live in Denmark, but only students can vote. Peder Villa is watching the debate closely.
But I'm trying to keep updated, like the main causes, like independence and the American situation.
Donald Trump's demands that the US acquire Greenland have clearly caused unease.
Can't just occupy us or like whatever. So whenever he says stuff like that, I feel like he's disrespecting us as a country, as a people.
The Arctic island's strategic location and untapped mineral resources have put it firmly in President Trump's sights. And addressing Congress last week, he doubled down.
We need Greenland for national security and even international security, and we're working with everybody involved to try and get it. And I think we're going to get it. One way or the other, we're going to get it.
Greenland's leaders have repeatedly rebuffed Trump, and in the snow-covered capital Nuuk, his comments are met with disbelief. Erik Jensen is the Deputy Prime Minister and the chair of Party Siumut.
It's a lack of respect for the democratic system in Greenland. When he said the Greenlandic people are incredible, it was followed by laughter from the hall, and the vice president started to laugh.
Javier Arnold is the head of Arctic Social Sciences at the University of Greenland in Nuuk.
It probably has amplified the voices of independence. March 11 will define what are the next steps towards that process of independence.
Moves towards more autonomy have been decades in the making. According to polls, most Greenlanders do back future statehood, but not at any cost.
80% of people are for independence, but at the same time, that independence is not at the expense of losing the standards of living that currently the Greenlandic society has.
The main political parties all support independence, but differ in their roadmap, explains Naya Bianco, a Danish Greenlandic consultant and Arctic policy expert.
4 out of 5 parties are pro-independence, but there's a difference in terms of how to achieve it and with which speed to achieve it.
The Prime Minister's party, IA, and coalition partner Siumut are the two biggest, and both favour a more gradual approach. While the Prime Minister is expected to retain popular support, smaller rivals are thought to gain ground and could shake up alliances, like pro-independence party, Nalarak. Its leader, Pelle Broberg, wants to kickstart divorce proceedings immediately.
Let's hope for a quick process. But as soon as we start that process, we have several other things that will start. One of them will be defense negotiations with the United States about the defense of Greenland when we are independent.
Pro-business party Demokratiet is also more cautious. Justin Hansen is a candidate.
I feel very strongly for the independence for Greenland, but not right now. We have to have more educated people. Our own local youth, but also economy, have to be much stronger.
In recent weeks, there's been controversy and anger over a now-withdrawn documentary made by Danish public broadcaster DR about a valuable creolite mine which Denmark controlled for 130 years. And the betrayal of an Inuit woman by a Danish comedy show sparked racism claims and triggered anti-discrimination protests. Greenland's right to self-determination is enshrined in a 2009 law. But whatever the outcome of this election, experts are clear. Any potential independence referendum is unlikely before Donald Trump's second term is over. Kai Kleist is one of Greenland's former top civil servants.
There is a lot of preparation to make before, and negotiations with the Danish government before you can make that a reality. I think the most realistic time is about 10 to 15 years.
Back in the sports hall, as FC Nanuk wraps up training, Malik shares his thoughts.
I know a lot of people are feeling that the independence talking points are taking too much focus away from topics that should be discussed, which is part of our normal everyday up there. Of course, I'm pro-independence at some point, but you've got to be careful and take your time.
And that was Malik Bertelsen, ending that report by Adrian Murray in Copenhagen, looking ahead to Greenland's elections on Tuesday. This is NewsHour. You're with the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour, live from London. Syria's Ministry of Defence says that military operations are over in the coastal provinces of Latakia and Tartus after hundreds of civilians were reportedly killed there by the government's own security forces. The region is the heartland of the country's Alawite minority, who were previously seen as the main supporters of the ousted president, Bashar al-Assad. The BBC's Lina Sinjab is in Damascus. Is there any more clarity on what exactly happened in the last few days?
The whole country has been taken by shock of the events unfolding. It started on Thursday with an ambush attack, by Assad remnants from the Alawite community, who killed dozens of the security forces, current security forces. And then the government sent, reinforcement to the coastal cities. But among this reinforcement, there were also factions that are now regulated in the official army, in the official security, who are blamed for the killing and for the looting of Alawite, homes. There are reports that they were accompanied by also foreign fighters, presumably Chechens, according to different witnesses, and some other, civilians who held up arms and joined the killing. And that's really shocked the country, caused anger and fear, not only among the Alawite community, but even among people who, wanted to oust the Assad regime, basically saying, this is not what we revolted for. We cannot have people practicing same atrocities that Assad did, and to be among the rulers. And that forced, the interim president to come out twice within the course of 4 or 5 days to address the nation. And lately, yesterday, he basically announced already forming a committee of judges, lawyers, and army officers to investigate the killing, to hold everyone who has blood on their hands accountable, whether they are Assad remnants of the Assad regime or members of the army. He said they will not tolerate anyone violating and, attacking any civilians. And he also said that there would be a committee formed for the ensuring a civil peace, especially for the coastal areas, to protect the families there.
I mean, the reports are absolutely horrific of what happened in these coastal provinces. Is it possible to assess how much residual support there may well have been for Bashar al-Assad in these places?
I think I've spoken to many families who are really scared and hiding, families who've lost members of their, loved ones. And really, the base for support for Bashar al-Assad ended long time ago, even before the toppling of Assad, because people were impoverished, and really suffering. It's only, a certain amount of people who were benefiting from the regime of Bashar al-Assad. And now those remnants who are hiding in the mountains, they are the security officers who are blamed for the killing, the torturing, the barrel bombs on Syrians over the past years. And they are the ones who have interest in destabilizing the situation.
Our correspondent in Damascus, Lina Sinjab. For most of the last 80 years, the Finnish city of Tampere has had a Lenin Museum, a museum dedicated, as its name suggested, to one of the founding figures of the former Soviet Union. It was a symbol, a small symbol perhaps, of Finland's neutrality all through the Cold War, of trying to maintain good relations with its massive neighbour to the east, as much as countries to the west. But now the museum has reopened under a different name, a different branding, and a different approach to thinking about the place of Russia in recent history. The museum director is Kalle Kallio.
Nootti is the new name for the former Lenin Museum here in Tampere, and Nootti refers to a diplomatic note. Those notes countries sent to each other, and in Finnish historical memory, we had quite a strong memory related to notes sent from Moscow. So that's clearly the reference to the name. And of course, there behind, we had a Lenin Museum. It was the last Lenin Museum in Western countries since the 1946. And we were a lot misunderstood. We were focusing on Soviet history, but the name created some kind of wrong understanding about what's our role and what our aims. And we wanted to have like a more neutral name for the museum.
You've eschewed the name Lenin Museum, but it sounds also as if you decided that even something like a museum of Soviet history would be potentially a bit too controversial at this time. Is that right?
Well, not exactly. We have this idea of transnational history because most of the museums focus on national stories, like design in Finland or railways in Finland. But when we think about Finnish history, it's so tied with the Russian history that it's actually impossible to understand very key events of our story if we are not aware of development in Russia. So we want to put these together in this new museum to tell the stories of both countries and how they connect to each other.
I'm trying to work out whether there is a little bit of regret in your voice that it has come to this, that you feel that there's had to be a change in this way.
Well, no, I'm not regretting anything. People had some kind of assumption that because our name for historical reasons was still a Lenin Museum, we had to explain it all the time. We had to every time tell that why the museum exists and what we are doing, and we are not a temple of evil, that we are working with the history and so on. With the new name, we don't have that kind of a burden.
During the Cold War, do you think that there was a bit of a sense in Finland that actually, because of Finland's special position geographically, that it was a little bit difficult to criticize the Soviet Union?
It was not only a little bit difficult, but it was very difficult. We even have this concept of Finlandization, which was actually born in Germany, this concept that how a small country adapts itself to its bigger neighbor and how our politics try to please the Soviet interest. It was, for instance, said that the Finnish government had to have trust from the Finnish parliament and from the Soviet Union to be stable. Because if we had a government which didn't have good relations with the Soviet Union, there would be like some reactions related to trade or some other issues. And of course, this Finlandization is very interesting in a way that nowadays there is like a speech that this Finlandization could be a solution, for instance, for Ukraine. As Finns, we try to say that no, it's not. It's not a good solution for anybody.
Fascinating. Kalle Kallio, director of that museum in Tampere that's had a name change. That brings this edition of NewsHour to a close. From me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London, thanks for your company.